Greetings. Guess I could say good afternoon. I guess you all figured it was going to be my turn, right? Just by process of elimination. So that's the visual aid over there. And the talk is called Sabbath and the Eightfold Path. So we've been on a journey together. It's a journey of intertwining roadways and multilingual signposts. Nonetheless, I believe the journey is unified in purpose and direction. It's a journey of unification, uniting the finite and the infinite, time and eternity, multiplicity and oneness, form and emptiness. It's a journey toward greater freedom. It's a journey of human evolution toward a future of less suffering, less greed, less hatred, more kindness and love. Tonight I want to talk about two sets of practices, one drawn from Judaism and one from the Dharma, the Buddha Dharma. They are each fundamental to their tradition. I'm talking about Shabbat and the Eightfold Path. As you will see, the Eightfold Path, and as you probably know, has been a major part of the curriculum. But we've not introduced it to you in particular, this particular configuration. I don't think we've ever talked about it. It's in the books you've read, and its substance is familiar territory to all of you. So at first I thought I was going to do a systematic, schematic comparison to show how the Sabbath and the Eightfold Path were mirrors of each other, and each step on the path correlates to a practice, text, or principle of Shabbat. But I realized I had to renounce that desire to impress you with my didactic precision. So this will be more impressionistic and evocative than precise. And I gave up something which is important because renunciation is really at the heart of both the Eightfold Path and these two rubrics and the Sabbath. And I know you've had your fill of the numbers over the year. It's hard to remember the fives and the sevens and the eights, never mind the fours and the threes and the tens. And Jews have numbers too, you know that. And it's an irony that these numbers are there to help us, right? That's why they came up with numbers. And yet sometimes they cause us anxiety because we said, what was that number? Oh, you know, it takes a long time to actually integrate in the mind the number. Okay, the Eightfold Path. You know. But the Eightfold Path is the fourth noble truth. It's the fourth noble truth. And what is the essence of the four noble truths? Freedom from suffering comes from letting go of craving or attachment. And how do we manage that? The practices of the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path comprises three sections as well. They don't divide equally, but three sections. Wisdom, meditation, or working with consciousness, and ethics. And when Jeff and I first started teaching way back when at Elah Chaim, Jeff and Joanna's retreat center, we divided our retreats, particularly when we did, all the time we used the rubric of Torah, Avodah, Gemilut, Chasadim. Joanna talked about that the other night. Torah, worship, and acts of loving kindness. The world stands on three pillars. And these are really exactly parallel to the three categories in the Eightfold Path, which include the factors of developing wisdom, Torah, consciousness, service of the heart. We could call it many different things, avodah, working with consciousness, I like to call it. And working on the ethics, how we treat each other, relationships. Fundamentally, that's it. Those are the three things. We also learned that three primary training mechanisms thread through the Eightfold Path. Three primary things. And you hear them again and again. We don't say anything new. We just keep saying it again and again in different ways. It's just hard to get it in. So these are the three primary mechanisms. First, our actions have consequences. Second, letting go. Third, kindness. And all journeys depend on a certain good, orderly direction. Good, orderly direction. That's a acronym for G-O-D. We trust, not original. We trust that we live in a created universe structured in such a way that we can journey toward greater freedom, wisdom, and love. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks phrases it, from the outset, the world has an objective moral structure. As the natural world is governed by scientific law, so the human world is governed by moral law. At the core of each path, so that's the first thing, and I'll talk more about it, that things have a consequence. The second, at the core of each path, we're asked to let go. If we are developing wisdom, we need to be questioning and flexible about our habituated and often defensive views. As we train in ethics, we surrender what we want, when we want it. In meditation and prayer, we are ever letting go of distraction, aversion, striving, grasping, perfectionism. Practicing kindness, the third one, complements and supports the letting go. It saturates everything from right view to right concentration. Kindness itself is an expansive, releasing quality of mind and heart, whether directed inward or outward, that dissolves the clinging, constricted, and often unwholesome states. As teachers, we need to practice letting go and kindness all the time. The biggest attachment for teachers, at least in my experience, is the desire to be loved. We've talked about that. When we teach mindfulness, it is entirely possible that students will feel their blocks more acutely and be caught more dramatically by the deluded mind. The teacher is a good blame object, the teacher, the program, whatever it happens to be. Still, through an attitude of gentleness and kindness, we invite our students and ourselves to return again and again to a soft encounter with our own discomfort, the uncomfortable, the unpleasant. I was teaching a mindful eating session recently at a Shabbos meditation retreat in a town I was invited to visit. And afterwards, someone mentioned that both she and another participant in this retreat had bariatric surgery, which is a surgery to shrink their stomachs. I thought I knew what it was, but they had this serious surgery, and then each of them had subsequently gained some of the weight back. And, you know, whenever I teach mindfulness, I always say that everybody has eating issues, and we all live in a really major eating, huge eating issues and struggles, and the first world and all of that. But these women were really triggered, really triggered. Still, they hung in there, although one sort of ran out, and then the other one told me what had happened, ran at the end, and then the other one told me what happened. And I was tempted to think, first of all, oh, I must have really upset them, you know, and which is a code for maybe they don't like me. Maybe they won't like me, right? I've upset them, they won't like me. But when I let go of that need, I recognized that this was a huge gift, actually, to allow them to be in a safe environment where they can be uncomfortable in a vast sea of kindness and release. So I made this, these are the steps. Sometimes I'm going to call them right, but I actually like the word wise better, so maybe I'll switch back and forth. Wise rather than right. Right gives that kind of constricted feeling, you know, wrong, right. But wise is I like better. And those are their eight steps, but it's a mistake to see them in a linear way, which is why I made that circle, because they're really more of a spiral, and they keep folding back onto each other, you know. It's kind of like the spherot. You can make a list of them, but they're all intertwined, and they're all very connected. Oh, there's another talk for you, the Sphirot and the Eightfold Path, but then the seventh is internet, never mind. So the first step on the Eightfold Path is right view, wise view. And wise view states that wholesome actions yield favorable results and unwholesome actions yield unfavorable results. This is also the starting point of the Torah. The world created by the Creator is good at its root. Ultimately, every seed will ripen according to what it is. In other words, our efforts are worthwhile. This is really an act of faith and trust. It is so deeply embedded in our orientation by the time we become practitioners that we don't always recall it. It does not mean that bad things don't happen. Of course they do, and to good people all the time. There are many things outside the purview of our intentionality and freedom to control. However, there are many ways that we can live free lives, lives of less constriction and suffering, if we align ourselves with the wholesome and turn aside from the unwholesome. All the other steps unfold from this starting point. This leads to step two, right intention or right thinking, which understands that the root of speech and action in the world is in thought. We have it in L'cha Dodi, Sof Ma'aseh B'machshava Tachila. The end of action starts in thought. The end of deed starts in thought. And there are three aspects to right thinking. So it gets more complicated, but right thinking or right intention. And that can be called, I didn't say, but Joseph Goldstein calls it right thinking. That's number two. And there are three aspects to it. Again, we're going to come back to the pieces that we've talked about. The three aspects are renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness or compassion. Same thing, again. These are our intentions. Renunciation and goodwill, harmlessness or compassion. So renunciation, I believe, is the counterintuitive training bar for all our development as humans. Here, we didn't assign this book, but there's a very little book, and I'll quote from it a bit. Bhikkhu Bodhi seems to have saturated our time together, at least in my own consciousness. Jeffrey. He has a very small book, a very good book, that Joseph actually quotes in his book, Mindfulness. It's called The Noble Eightfold Path. He writes, desire is to be abandoned not because it is morally evil, but because it is a root of suffering. This renunciation, turning away from craving and its drive for gratification, becomes the key to happiness, to freedom, and the hold of attachment. It is to pass from gross entangling pleasures to an exalted happiness and peace, from a condition of servitude to one of self-mastery. Desire ultimately breeds fear and sorrow, but renunciation gives fearlessness and joy. The invitation to cultivate goodwill, kindness, harmlessness, or compassion is the best way to work with unwholesomeness in our lives. You've been doing this, we've been hawking this from now till doomsday, it's in all the readings everywhere. Non-contention allows whatever constriction arises to release. It is the most effective way of working with ill will as opposed to yielding to it, yielding to ill will, or repressing ill will. The viability of our practice relies on the fact that whatever one reflects on frequently becomes the inclination of the mind. And you may have noticed that. You just may notice that on this retreat. And this has been scientifically proven now. They call this neuroplasticity, one of the things they call it. So let's just take a moment and think about Shabbat from the point of view of right view and right intention and right thinking. And, you know, you can do endless drashot on this. You know, you can go with this really big. I'm just going to, like, highlight a couple of little possibilities here. Here's a prayer by Rabbi Natan of Nemirov, disciple of Rabbi Nachman. He writes, have compassion for me. Help me merit to be joyous with a full heart on the Holy Shabbat. And through this happiness, I may pass from slavery to freedom. And through the joy and freedom of Shabbat, let me expand and perfect my consciousness. With the greatest expansion and perfection, all according to your benevolent will. And I will not fear anything else in the world. The verse will be manifest in me as it is written, God is my light and my redemption. Whom shall I fear? God is the stronghold of my life. Whom shall I dread? So if I pray this prayer, what am I doing? I'm basically letting go. I'm letting go of my story, of my personal troubles and woes. I'm orienting my heart and mind toward well-being and joy. And that is unrelated to me getting my desires met. And I'm moving toward a freedom born of this release where I naturally choose the wholesome and the life-affirming. I am resting in the view that if I orient toward the good, the wholesome, the expanded perspective, it will be there for me. Shabbat is the great practice of affirmation. We affirm creation and goodness. It was good. We affirm that creation is good, we have a path, and we are guided on the journey. This allows us to be willing to let go. And we let go of a huge amount on Shabbat. If we practice Shabbat in any way, shape, or form, and there are different ways of doing it, but the idea of Shabbat, the practice of Shabbat, basically we let go of everything we identify ourselves as ourselves for 6 days of the week. We are no longer workers, consumers, producers, creators. Ideally, we let go of the mundane desires for self-aggrandizement, for success and competitive advantage in the marketplace or the academy. We also let go of our fears and anxieties and our compulsive need to control. Shabbat appears in time, but it touches the beyond time. Heschel, Olam Haba, the world to come, is modeled on Shabbat, or Shabbat is modeled on the world to come, however you want to put it. It's a day, but it's also a perspective that shines on our week, just as we have the seven-branch candelabrum and the centerpiece of that, of the menorah, the seven, if that's the week, it's 3 days build up to the Shabbat and 3 days go down from the Shabbat. It's not like Shabbat's over here and then we go. No, Shabbat is shining on our lives. That's the idea. All the other days bask in its light. This is from Ethan Fishbane, who wrote a lovely book on the Shabbat. He says, the Sabbath is ever renewed, mysterious, and surprising, even as it arrives in as a familiar old friend. Likrat Shabbat lechu v'nelcha. Let us go forth again to greet the Sabbath in the fields and on the pathways of this earth. She is always present soul of our ordinary lives, calling us beneath the veils of existence, leading us on our quest for spiritual purpose in this world. Miriam did a beautiful teaching on that today. On Shabbat, the world is complete, like the second loaf of challah, like the sense of shalom, shleimut, wholeness, the muscle that allows us to let go of the unwholesome temptations in our lives is actually honed in this practice. Rabbi Sacks, Shabbat is not merely a day of rest. It is a rehearsal within time, a rehearsal, a practice for the age beyond time. When humanity, guided by the call of God, moves beyond strife, evil, and oppression to create a world of harmony, respecting the integrity of creation as God's work and the human person as God's image. Shabbat is also, on the second morning of this retreat, Shabbat is also a rehearsal for the week to come, as our formal practices are rehearsals for our lives off the cushion, as we've talked about many times. Some of you know that I was a passenger in a car accident in December, and no one else was hurt in the car, but I had a very wounded chest right here. It's still a little residual, but I really, really recovered. But it was really quite painful for a while. And after about a month of pain, I kept bargaining with my mind. Should I do stuff or not do stuff? You know, take drugs, not take drugs. You know, mostly I was walking around with a hot water bottle here the whole time. I went to California to teach a retreat, the IJS Chevraya retreat. And I knew I couldn't teach yoga, which I was supposed to do, and I asked some of my friends to be sure, like, I didn't overdo it. I was really scared to go in the vulnerable state I was in. And on the second morning of the retreat, there's always, it's out in California, there's always a silent walk up in the foothills, and then there's a davening up there, and they get up very early. I mean, talk very early, but it's early, and before the sun comes up, and this is winter, and the people who lead it are really great prayer leaders, and I knew I should not go. I knew I shouldn't go. I barely had the energy to teach my own class. You know, I was revving myself up. But I felt guilty. I felt guilty. I felt it was a slight to the leaders. Here I was one of the teachers, and I wasn't going to one of the people's things. And I was also afraid. I didn't really want to miss the group experience. And I was stranded somewhere between wholesome and unwholesome drive. It was quite painful and constricting, and I really needed help, and no one was there. And I couldn't just do the letting go by myself. I needed a source of compassion to surround me and guide me. And at that moment, I opened in prayer. And I asked my higher power to remove the guilt, the desire, the obsessive need to be everywhere, and to allow me to rest in this little bit of healing and self-care. Amazingly enough, my prayer was heard. And I received an ease of mind and heart. Heart, that was the place of the wound, right here. And the compassion allowed for the arising of the renunciation of ego and the story that were not, in this particular case, wholesome. They may have been in other circumstances, but here they really weren't. It was self-destructive. And I got out of the center of my story. I was calm and at peace. And, you know, no one really noticed that I wasn't there. Or if they did, no one said anything. So it was totally fine, of course. It was all, you know, the drama in our own minds. So Shabbat offers a day of letting go and loving kindness. Candles are lit to light our way. Our Friday night prayers begin with Yadid Nefesh, you who love my soul. They continue with Psalms extolling creation, filled with song and joy to orient and direct our minds. Then we chant Ana Bekoach, source of mercy, untie my tangles. Prelude to Lecha Dodi, come, my beloved, release yourself from all that is encumbering your sweet soul, your worried, downcast face, your furrowed brow. Arise, wake up, Hitori, Hitnari. Embrace your own expanded self, your own expanded soul, your essential goodness, your radiance, completeness. We are moving together toward the truest joy, simcha v'sason, and most expansive freedom. Kindness is definitely the theme of Shabbat. The spaciousness and altered time sustains and supports the choice of kindness. The essence of the one we worship is kindness. Harachaman. The one thing we know that is not truly impermanent, that survives death, that beckons immortality, is kindness, is love. The proof text, Psalm 136, which has its refrain, Ki li olam chasdo, for loving kindness is eternal. Everything else arises and passes. On Shabbat, we have more time for practice. Prayer practice is a way to sweeten the mind and develop wisdom. It correlates with the eighth factor on the path, right concentration, wise concentration. Prayer, wise concentration, which is developed through meditation and prayer. A beautiful example of expansive prayer on Shabbat is the Nishmat Kol Chai. Words create a sense of fullness that is beyond the mind's ability to grasp or hold. We could not thank you enough for even one of the thousands and myriad favors. All our innermost being sings praises. The breath is so deep. Nishmat Kol Chai, the breath of all living. The soul is free, soaring. This is describing a profound state of concentration. Other special words in the Shabbat liturgy evoke the soul's qualities, the enduring gifts that are worth pursuing rather than the fleeting acquisitions that leave us pining for more suffering in our discontent. Yismach Moshe, Moses rejoiced at the gift of his portion, at the bringing of the Torah. Kulam yispa'u v'yitagu mituvecha. May we feel totally sated and filled with joy as we practice the Sabbath and recall in our depths how good creation is. Sabenu mituvecha v'samchenu b'shuatecha. May we feel deep contentment and a profound sense of safety. V'taher libenu l'avdecha b'emet. I spoke about this the first night. May our hearts and minds be developed, prepared to serve the highest purposes of truth, undistracted by confusion and delusion, not grasping the false. Shabbat continues into Mincha. In that liturgy, the word, we said this, menucha, rest, serenity, appears seven times in one paragraph, together with an idyllic description of a world at peace with itself. A world at peace with itself. A rest of love and generosity. A rest of truth and faith. A rest of peace and tranquility. Calm and trust. That's the liturgy. That's the liturgy. The Sabbath is an expression of the fruition of what are called the Brahma Viharas, the divine abodes. We had that whole month on the blessing practice. It's right there in Mincha. It is a call to journey toward that in our relationships and in the structure of living we support. We see the intertwining again and again of kindness and letting go in kindness, right thinking, right intention, leading to the next four points along the path, the Eightfold Path, right speech, right action, right livelihood, and right effort. The sublime states are watered by the practice of right mindfulness and right concentration, points 7 and 8. Then we loop backward toward the beginning factors of wisdom. In the most sublime states, we see the interconnection of all. When we're really deeply concentrated, we see it for ourselves. We see the relationship between seed and fruit and seed. The path is a spiral. Concentration, the deepest meditative experience or prayer experience, bears the fruit of right view. We see directly how we are not separate, how suffering is released, how fluid and iridescent all of life is, how we suffer when we forget and consider ourselves apart and alone. Our meditation and prayer practices and the practice of Shabbat are intended to bring us home to a personal knowledge of how the world works, how the mind works, how we can live with wisdom and compassion and make choices that are wholesome and loving. Right concentration, the eighth step on the path, results from a deliberate attempt to raise the mind to a higher, more purified level of awareness. This allows a direct seeing into the real nature of phenomena. The truest renunciation of the unwholesome, the ignorant, the crude, and delusional, is born out of the experience of deep seeing and understanding, not just reading a book or having someone tell you about it. That's why we're here. That's why we practice. Back to kindness. Goodwill. That is what we need to remember on Shabbat and every day. We let go of the 39 malachot, the tasks that the children of Israel undertook to construct the sanctuary. That's a tradition. We let go of building on Shabbat. Why? Because the sanctuary is right here. We wake up to embrace ourselves and each other in love. We meet each moment fully, we meet it as a friend. I had two small and enormous experiences of kindness, really, recently. They were small, but they were enormous. Some of you know that Jeff and I were invited in, what was it, November. It was after this retreat we went. Jeff and I were invited to a Japanese Buddhist group called the Shinyo-en to visit Japan and be part of a pilgrimage to holy Buddhist and Shinto sites on an interfaith contemplative dialogue with a very small group of Christians, Buddhists, Muslims, Hindus, and Jews. Jeff and I were the Jews. And, you know, it was a very good choice, we thought. It was a fabulous time. We had a fantastic time. I'm not supposed to speak for Jeff. I had a fantastic time. And the hospitality was legendary. The food was incredible. The beauty overwhelming. And I was especially really touched by the attention to detail, the precision. There was like an aura of mindfulness, kind and loving awareness moment to moment in just the way they cared for the land and each garden, each everything that was served. You know, you've had a little taste of that, those of you who haven't been to Japan, but know that. And the last day of the retreat, Jeff and I had to take a bus from, we were in Kyoto, and we had to take a bus about a two-hour ride to Osaka, where we're going to get our plane back to the States. And the rest of the group mostly had left. We were with one of the other leaders and from this group called the Global Initiative, Peace Initiative of Women. And we were staying somewhat outside of Kyoto, and we wanted to shop. You know, we didn't have a lot of shopping, you know, we were going to go shopping. So, and, you know, we had all our luggage and our packs and everything, and they said, well, we'll take you in to Kyoto, and you can check your baggage at the bus stop, and then you can be free to wander around and shop, because you don't want to be schlepping your luggage while you're shopping. So that was fine, and they drove us in. They were very nice, and it turned out it was a super big holiday. It was, I don't remember what the holiday was. They have a huge number of holidays in Japan, as far as I could tell. But anyway, this was, it was Labor Day or something like that. Anyway, it was also height of the maples, the Japanese maples, red. It was amazing. And everybody was flooding into Kyoto, and all of the lockers were full. So the gentleman who had brought us in said, no worries. I will just stay with your luggage for a few hours while you shop. Okay. I mean, I was like, really? I never would have asked anybody to do that. And it was just like such a simple act. And I was just overwhelmed that he was willing just to sit for a few hours. We wandered off. We came back. We took our baggage. And then just as we were in the bus, it was so incredibly sweet. As we were in the bus going to the airport, he was waving goodbye to us. You know, it was just so, it made me feel so good. All of that kindness, it just went into me. It made me feel so good. And then a few weeks later, I had another encounter on my way from Philadelphia to Los Angeles. And nowadays, I don't know. Lately, it's been happening that even if I buy a ticket with my husband to go someplace, we'll both get middle seats. Yeah. I mean, what's up with that? Like, we don't have enough clout to, like, get to sit next to each other, you know? It's like, and I don't like that. I mean, I don't care sitting in the middle. I sit in the middle, and he sits on the aisle. But at least I'd like to be with him on the airplane. I'm a little nervous of a flyer. Anyway, okay, I'm working with it. Well, I'll get from here to there, and it's okay. And sure enough, we were, you know, moving our peck lock around, and I guess I probably looked a little. And this woman, out of the clear blue sky, she said, oh, I'll take the middle. She had an aisle seat. She said, I'll take the middle seat. For this whole trip, she just offered her middle seat to us. And I was practically in tears. I was so touched. It was so generous, so kind. You know, it just melted the separation, those moments, you know, liberated heart. And I trust that she felt good about it too. And the man that sat with our bags, you know, it's really, there's some kind of safety and willingness to be with that allows that to flourish. So another aspect of the Eightfold Path mirror the intention and practice of Shabbat. Moving on. But it's all saturated. It's all keeps coming back. So the area of ethics. Step 3 is right speech. Step 4 is right action. Step 5 is right livelihood. Step 6 is right effort. So on Shabbat, we're advised, not here, but in a normal Shabbat, to be more careful of our speech than usual, to steer away from planning for tomorrow, business speech, mundane speech, making calculations, or anything that causes sadness or agony. We are enjoined to use the special greeting, Shabbat Shalom. You know, we think that, oh, Shabbat Shalom, but Shabbat Shalom. But right speech is closely connected to the regular Jewish practice of speech that we've had in our curriculum, speech that is truthful and non-harming. The Mincha time on Shabbat is a time of closeness and unity, and our practice is designed to move us in that direction, just as Shabbat is designed to move us in that direction, toward echad, oneness. Joseph Goldstein writes that speech is a mirror of our minds. If we practice speech that is timely, true, gentle, connected with the good, spoken with loving kindness in the mind, and if we refrain from slander, gossip, harsh, angry, or abusive speech that is not frivolous, are we not moving toward the fullness of Shabbat? Hard, hard, hard work. Goldstein asks us to reflect on our motivation before we speak. Again, intention, speech. Motivation, thinking, speech. Are we making ourselves important, aggrandizing our egos? He says, is it our intention to divide or bring people together? Just paying attention to this one question could change our lives. Is it our intention to divide or bring people together? This one question, attention to this one question, could change our lives. Wouldn't it be powerful just to have that strong intention for our Shabbat practice? It might transform the other days of the week. Right action, now, right action and right effort sound like they're the same thing, but right action is different than right effort. I want to explain what they are. Right action, we saw, remember the precepts? We had the 5 precepts. Well, right action is 3 of those precepts. 3 things. Not taking life, not taking what is not freely given, and refraining from sexual misconduct. That's what called right action. Okay? Ethical commitments that create a safe container in which we can explore more deeply. Taken with right speech, they resemble, and then we have Shabbat, you know, well, they resemble the Ten Commandments. We have quite a few of the Ten Commandments interwoven there. So right action is a true Sabbath practice. If we think of it as withdrawing from the marketplace and finding ease and peace with what we have instead of what we need. It's particularly hard for people not to run, I've noticed, not to run errands on the Sabbath, to give up running errands. And also the electronic universe that we inhabit, always revving up our desire for something better, newer, more. Our time on retreat, even if it is not Shabbat, is also a Shabbat practice, clearly. So renunciation leads us to explore what is truly wholesome, satisfying, and joyful. The opposite of the negative precept of right action is the cultivation of Shabbat consciousness. Desiring the well-being of others, honesty, contentment, generosity, and fidelity. In other words, the opposite of the things you're not supposed to do, the things you're supposed to do. Cultivating caring, generosity, as opposed to taking what's not freely offered, etc. We're back to renunciation because it threads through everything. It takes us back to impermanence, which is liberating. If we don't indulge desire, it does pass as long as we don't judge it harshly and open in kindness to this very desire. Sometimes the path to liberation leads through developing the capacity to stay with discomfort. Oh boy, not easy. I read a phenomenal book, I was telling Joanna, by a sociologist called Alice Goffman. It's called On the Run. I really recommend it. She spent 6 years living in Philadelphia in the inner city in a black community community of African Americans, and many in this community spend their lives hopelessly entangled in a life of violence and crime, perennially pursued and persecuted by the criminal justice system. Alice is a white, privileged, highly educated, half-Jewish young woman who managed to delve deeply into the quality and structure of this very different community. And in a lengthy discussion of her research methodology, she writes, "My task was not to let my comfort level guide my inquiry." The brilliance of this book is a direct product of her methodology. And as she says, "I tried to be careful not to give greater weight to the places and situations where I was most at ease." Wow, that's very impressive. I had a recent experience. My sister-in-law turned 75, and my husband's sister, and her four children and 10 grandchildren, the eldest being 9 years old, decided to give her a surprise pizza party at a karaoke club for her 75th birthday. And it was important that we went. My husband's very close with her. And we went up to New Haven from Philadelphia. It's a long trip, round trip in one day. It was on the eighth day of Pesach. Okay, I'm a Reconstructionist. The eighth day, all right, Mela. It was also Shabbat. It was a four-hour long party with high volume karaoke music chosen by the older grandchildren, shall we say. I found myself irritated, constricted, my mind going crazy, wondering if I was going to last. And I mentioned my discomfort to Maynard, my husband, and he said, "Look, this party makes my sister very happy. That's what it's for. If you don't like it, that's okay. It's not your party." And I was struck by the wisdom of this comment and the call for my relaxation. Right action, non-conflict, loving kindness toward myself, who was the one in pain in this case. It was also the reminder of impermanence, would end eventually, generosity, and letting go of always feeling comfortable as a gateway to generosity. Releasing my bad attitude, in a way, was one of the most Shabbistic things I could do. Joseph Goldstein writes regarding right action and right speech, "What motivates and energizes us to make this effort are precisely the previous steps on the path. As we understand through right view the selfless interconnected aspect of all things, and as we cultivate right thought of renunciation, loving kindness, and compassion, then we are moved to speak and act in such a way that minimizes harm and is conducive to the welfare of all." Step five is right livelihood. And just to say, I like this definition by Goenka. "If the intention is to play a useful role in society in order to support oneself and to help others, then the work one does is right livelihood." I don't want to go into it in a way Shabbat is about right livelihood, in a sense that it gives you a distance from your livelihood so that you might be able to know if it's right livelihood or not, except for rabbis, of course. Step six, right effort. Right effort, as opposed to right action. Wise effort. In this case, wise effort. And we've discussed this, but I want to review it because it's very powerful. It's a magnificent rubric for us to understand the essence of our practice. And it's the heart of what the rest, the wholeness and ease of Shabbat are meant to prepare and strengthen and inspire us to do. We rest so that we can make right effort. That is truly what we do, because the starting point is the defiled mind, the afflicted, the deluded. The goal is the liberated mind. The work of self-cultivation is not easy. There is no one to do it for us but ourselves, but it is not impossible. Shabbat is a reminder of the Exodus and a call to ongoing liberation of self and others. We may also say it's an enjoinder to be holy, kadoshim to you. Or as the Sfat Emet, we've spoken, Himbergal says, God, liberate me from the imprisonment of my soul. Hotzia mimazger nafshi, the redemptive power of the Sabbath, he says. The seventh day is a time of otherworldly freedom in which we are able to break free of the walls that constrain us during the 6 days of the week. In holy time, we step outside of ourselves, beyond the anochiyut, the ego, the selfhood of ordinary life, and are able to experience the ultimate freedom of consciousness. This is, again, the intention. Okay, what is right effort? You know what this is. Think of it as the rubric, the four boxes. Prevent the arising of unwholesome states not yet arisen. Don't walk into a bar if you're an alcoholic. Abandon unwholesome states already arisen. We've been exploring technology via how to abandon unwholesome states. That whole business about the five hindrances, that's all about working with, not in a harsh way, not in an angry way, in a loving way, working with the hindrances. And that's including, Joseph says that we have an inner remote control with an ability to change channels. And our practice, including Shabbat, cultivate, repair, and sustain this remote control. Two boxes around unwholesome and around wholesome, arouse wholesome states that have not yet arisen. And it's here we meet the seven factors of enlightenment. Go back to your books. I'm not going to go through them. The seven factors of enlightenment. Factors that lead to awakening because they constitute awakening. We're back into the numbers. And wholesome, maintain and strengthen those wholesome states that have arisen. Teaching, hint. A great deal of your practice and your teaching will be about wholesome and unwholesome states, will be exactly about this right effort. A lot of it will be about that. Finding the action, finding the language to deal with it. Finding the language to deal with it. Ongoing exploration of that in your own lives, your own minds. Step seven, right mindfulness, which is also one of the seven factors of enlightenment. Imagine devoting Shabbat to mindfulness. Okay, Vishamru v'nei Yisrael, Vishamru, Shamor, Shmira, mind the Sabbath. The mindful practice, the Sabbath is, Zachor, Jordan has given us, Zechira, remember, Sati, mindfulness. Remember, the two words, Shamor v'Zachor, the Sabbath, are both words for mindfulness. The Sabbath is a mindfulness practice. And just as we've given you suggestions, various kinds of suggestions for how to bring this back. Joanna talked about starting a sitting group. Jordan talked about working with text. Jeff has given us that whole rubric of integrating prayer and many other things. My suggestion, Sabbath. 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 Mindfulness. Sabbath. Sabbath. Shabbat. Okay, that's your chart. Okay, you got four really great practical modalities. So we studied and practiced mindfulness, and I just want to give you one. We've done a lot with that. I won't even go back with it to discuss what it is because we're getting close to Shabbat, so I'm not going to do that. And we've also talked about right concentration, wholesome one-pointedness, the quality alluded to in the evening prayer for protection, Hashkivenu, which is altered for the Friday night liturgy, from spread, beseeching, spread your canopy over us. Now we say, who spreads the canopy of peace over us. Again, the Sabbath goes from longing for it to acknowledging its presence. And that's the practice of concentration, coming one-pointed, coming back again. It's here, it's here, it's here. What's here, what's here? The concentrated mind is one that is the shelter of peace. So This past January, on Martin Luther King birthday, I went to a march and rally in Philadelphia with my daughter, part of the Black Lives Matter and all of that in the cities. And I went with my daughter and her kids, and Hadassah, who's 8 and a half, was listening to the speakers from the podium. And afterwards, she said to me, "Grandma, if the black people have been hurt so badly and are so angry, when they get power, will they do to the whites what the whites did to them?" And I said, "Wow, that's a great question, you know." And that's why the Torah says, love the stranger. And that's why all of this, everything, it's all about working with that. Because sure, we were wounded, we're going to wound. She sees that as a child. Child sees that. We are strangers in the land of Egypt. This means we're told not to act out of our hurt and anger, but to love the stranger. Even though we may have been hurt, we need to love those who are hurting. The concentrated mind is a gateway to wisdom, non-separation, and love. Concentrated mind comes back to right view, wise view, connection, interconnection, loving kindness, intention. So Shabbat ends with Havdalah, of course, and we will end with Havdalah as well, even though this is Friday night. We are back to renunciation, Havdalah, and we yield to the cycle of time and the rhythms of day and night. We let go of something we love. We let go of Shabbat and return to the practice of the world of multiplicity and separation. The Chevraya retreat in January, I referenced it, was a very, very powerful one. A couple of people were there. And a few people had insights into their lives and support for changes they wanted to make. And we always remind people when they leave retreats that they are more altered than they think they are. And this time, we probably didn't emphasize it enough. And I got a call from two people the day after the retreat, 2 days after the retreat, saying they were having a really, really hard time. One was steeped in unwholesome fantasies. The other one went home and told his wife all the life decisions that were so clear to him on retreat. And she freaked out, and they were fighting nonstop. So for a non-monastic tradition, which Judaism is, we need to cultivate, and we have guidance, the art of transition, the bridge between intensive retreat practice and ordinary life. And Judaism has this awareness. We have Havdalah to carry us from the shelter of Shabbat into the open air of our lives. And it's a beautiful liturgy filled with protection, safety, and joy, with symbols of light and sweetness. And there's a blessing in our remembering, but there's also a blessing in our forgetting. We are beings who inhabit a fragile space between heaven and earth, as we have been taught many times by many of you, between light and darkness, between particular and universal. We are vulnerable. We are in process. We remember to release and relax into this moving watercolor of life. We are held in trust alone, in Yesod. So thank you for your attention.